Go behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hi, and welcome to the show. I'm Scott.
And I'm Ben, and today we are here with Noel the Collector Brown.
I didn't do very well on that one. Sounds like a serial killer.
It does. It sounds a little darker. Sorry, Noel. I don't mean to paint you in a bad light. We'll think of some better nicknames. And listeners, of course, you can always reply with a nickname for Scott, Noel, or myself. But today we are calling Noel the Collector Brown because today, Scott, you and I are returning to the world of car collections, but a different part of the world of car collections.
Absolutely. And this one comes from a listener suggestion from a longtime friend of the show, Rudy Smith.
Mm-hmm.
And Rudy wrote in recently, and I think we did read this one during a recent Nuts and Bolts episode.
I believe so, yeah.
Said we'd get to it, and here it is. We said we were going to talk about car collections of the Chinese rich and famous, because Rudy wrote in and said, and I quote, "Considering all the concentrated wealth in China and the popularity of luxury cars there, it occurred to me that there must be at least one Chinese gajillionaire with a penchant for collecting fine cars. I don't know if there is, but maybe you can use your research mojo to find out. I wonder if the high luxury taxes there have anything to do with the inconspicuous nature of car collecting." Now, this brought to mind a few different cases. Now, Rudy sent a bunch of links as well that we could check out.
Yeah.
And there were a number of interesting links there, of course, but we dug in a different direction on some of these. And, man, I got to tell you, Ben, I started to look at all these and I started to read all the stories and I started to kind of digest what was happening here. And more than anything, I found a lot of blowback from people on forums that were just outright upset or angered about these car collections or these pristine versions of American cars headed over to China. But I wonder, would it be the same if, you know, these collections were to be scattered throughout the United States? I mean, would they have the same reaction or not? I mean, there's a lot to talk about here, not just necessarily one person that's collecting cars. Although, did you say that you found somebody who may be a major collector in China? Is that right? We found a couple.
Yeah.
Did you find a name? Because what you said intrigued me that, you know, this, the one that we're going to talk about in particular is the Ratzoy collection that came from Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And he kept 100 cars. And I don't think I'm giving too much away here, but
no.
100 cars is like the beginning of a major collection for somebody. And do we find out who bought that collection? And is that one of the people that we know?
I am still looking for that.
Okay.
It's alluded to simply as a Chinese buyer.
See, you're not alone in this case, because I've looked for that as well, and I also could not find the name of the individual that purchased the Ratzoy collection. Now, I know it's probably out there somewhere. Someone knows who it is, but we talked about this during our Nuts and Bolts episode. A lot of times during some of these bigger auctions, and I don't know if this happened during the Microcar Museum auction or whatever, but, you know, when a major collection comes up for sale,
mm-hmm.
at the back of the room, there'll be somebody who – or front of the room sometimes – there are people who are on the phone with collectors that are not able to attend the show.
In person.
Yeah, so they're calling from sometimes here in the United States, sometimes Canada, sometimes Australia, sometimes they're mm-hmm. anywhere. They're anywhere in the world because as long as they get a phone collection, they know the auction's happening and they're able to buy and import the cars, they have a possibility of buying it just like anybody else. And so sometimes you'll hear that an anonymous Chinese buyer has purchased this vehicle, you know,
right.
There's never a name given and not never, but usually there's not a name given. And it happens more and more frequently recently. And a lot of people are taking note of that.
Right. And it could also, one of the questions someone might ask and logically ask is, well, if it's anonymous, then how do they know the country of origin of this person? Well, the way they would know that is because of where the vehicles are being shipped.
Sure. Yeah. Also, that's not something that's like as classified. I mean, they don't want the collection. I understand that somebody who buys a priceless piece of art doesn't necessarily want to broadcast that piece of art is now going to be stored in their home. That makes them a big target for crime or for whatever, you know, for some type of fraud.
Or in one of their homes.
Yeah, or one of their homes. That's right. So, you know, it's understandable they want to keep their anonymity. I get that. The country that it goes to, it seems like you could be outright with that information and just say where it's going to or, you know, who made the call. And not specifically who, but where the call came from.
Mm-hmm.
Seems like that's reasonable information to put out there.
I feel like that's not off base, but you know, in general, the idea of anonymity or discretion is huge for people buying stuff at auctions. And one thing we noticed, I'm glad you mentioned the blowback about this at the very top, because I was surprised by how upset some people seemed to be. I didn't understand, because I will tell you one thing. After looking at some of the legal restrictions imposed by the Chinese government, Chinese car collectors are putting in some serious work to get those vehicles over there.
Absolutely. They have to jump through a lot of hoops, as you would imagine, trying to get the car into what's a communist nation.
Yeah.
And it's very difficult to import just about anything, really. And I can imagine the stresses that they go through in order to import vehicles that were made in America prior to a point when they weren't necessarily allowed to even have their own private vehicles, because we found that out as we researched as well, that
right.
There was a point, and maybe I'm alone here, Ben, but I didn't really know this when I started this research procedure here, is that, you know, prior to 1949, that China, if you lived in China, you weren't allowed to own a private vehicle. That was something that was reserved for heads of state, for military. Mm-hmm. It was, I guess, what would you call it? Just state-issued vehicles, really.
Right, yeah, for transportation of goods. Now, of course, that's not to say, because we know corruption creeps into every government. So that's not to say that people didn't have a quote-unquote government vehicle that was theirs and that they parked at their house.
Oh, and I'm sure that happened often. There's,
right.
There's got to be cases or ways around that
yeah.
happened. But that also gave rise to, I'm sure that, you know, the motorized bicycle and scooter and all that, mm-hmm. that's why that became even more critical in that time frame for that nation.
So because of these legal restrictions, you could argue fairly effectively that car culture was either kind of stymied, or you could argue that it just took a very different direction. But that wasn't the only legal roadblock currently. It had been this way for a while. China had a lot of terrible automobile traffic. One of the last times we mentioned traffic in China, which was a very interesting thing, is that China had a 3-day traffic jam. Wasn't that? It was the
something
world's
like
longest
that, yeah.
traffic jam at the time. And I believe we talked about it on air. But additionally, just the sheer amount of individual vehicles in urban environments is crazy. And there have been different approaches or attempts to mitigate this situation by, you know, putting a different pay to drive lane up, which no one uses.
Sure.
Or to have a system based on the license plate about when you can buy a car, when and what day you can drive it.
Wow. Okay, so it's almost like watering restrictions here in the States.
Right, yeah.
We have
similar.
Like an odd even system for watering your lawn. But
right.
This is a driving your car situation with a license plate number indicating when you can and can't drive.
And one of the most pernicious or difficult laws, at least from a car collector's perspective, is that eventually authorities, based on all these traffic problems in cities across China, the authorities said that if your vehicle is over 15 years old, you can't drive it because we're concerned about the pollution.
Oh, my gosh. All right. So 15, it's just an outright age shutoff. And even if it still does pass their emission standards, sorry, no go, right? So 15 years old,
yep.
You got to trade that in and trade up. And what do? You get a car that's maybe 5 years newer, and then that's good for only – you know, 5 more years, right?
Right.
Am I thinking of that right? Yeah, I guess right. Unless you get a brand new vehicle that would be good for 15 years, you're constantly having to start over again after that 15-year time limit is up.
Right, but there, you know, this is something I want to open up to the listeners, because I believe there have to be some exceptions, and I want to hear more about this, because some of the collectors like Sun Jian and Lu Wenyao are owners of huge collections, right?
Yeah, I mean hundreds of cars.
Hundreds, yes, for sure. And they had in 2013, I want to say, October of 2013, they had a convoy of classic cars depart the Great Wall to drive to Shanghai, and it was the Classic Cars China Challenge.
Oh, cool. So that would be a super rarity, something that you would never, ever see there, because the cars that they own, some of them predate the 1949 restriction for the private vehicles because they're imported now. Others that just simply weren't available to the public. I mean, cars that were, you know, the state vehicles that we talked about pre-1949, of course, but then other vehicles that, you know, just simply weren't available because they haven't been imported en masse, I guess.
Right.
But in the situation of going over to a museum, that's a special situation, a special circumstance that I'm sure that's exactly what we're talking about when, you know, say it's a headache for someone to import 100 cars from the Ratzoy collection in Canada over there. I'm sure that, you know, it's saying, yeah, sure, they're over 15 years old. These are going to be museum cars. We're hardly ever going to drive them. The only time we'll drive them is maybe during a parade, maybe during, you know, a situation like that convoy that you talked about,
right,
driving to the auto show, to Shanghai, you know, in situations where they just want to get them out and stretch their legs a little bit. But it's probably limited in the way that, you know, supposedly our historic plates are limited here in the United States in a lot of cases where, you know, you're allowed a certain number of driving days a year if you have that, you know, that sticker on your plate that says it's a historic vehicle.
Right.
Or, you know, the limited situations, but everybody kind of goes around that anyway.
That's one of those laws that I have yet to see anybody busted for.
Yeah, it's never been really enforced, I don't think.
Before we dive into some of these collections, can we talk a little bit about that Classic Car Challenge?
I just
think it's interesting.
Yeah, sure. Let's do it.
All right. So this is a classic rally tour, which brings us to something else we should talk about too. But it's about 6 days, 1,800 kilometers, and it has it's approved by FIVA, the Fédération Internationale des Véhicules Anciens.
Very nice, Ben.
Really? That was terrible.
Well, you took us there. Took us there with that accent.
I took us somewhere. And the Classic Vehicle Union of China, CVUC, they drive from Beijing to Shanghai in 6 days. They've altered the route a little bit over time. It's had 2 million spectators. It ran in 2011, 2012, 2013, 2014. The festival is something that people love just to see this motorcade. Cause like you said, it's not something you see every day.
2 million spectators.
Mm-hmm.
That's huge.
That's huge. Well, I mean, given the numbers of the country's population, it's believable.
Well, that's tiny then.
Yeah. It's pocket change, right? But so all of that just to say that we know there is a market for these vehicles. We know that people enjoy seeing them and driving them. Well, at least watching them, and a lot of people want to drive them. And we know that some people who are particularly successful in China have been able to amass some fantastic collections. And a few of these people have also made their collections part of museums so that an ordinary person who can't buy 200 cars can go look at them.
Sure. So some people are gathering, let's say, their collection of 10. With other people who have a collection of 10 or 15
sure.
or 5 or whatever, and they make one massive collection out of that. So they're combined. That happens in our museums here in the States as well. You know, these are on loan from, you know, so-and-so, and that happens often. But, you know, in this case, you know, with China, throughout the entire country, I think the Hemmings article that I read about this says that the classic car museums of China is limited to something like, you know, like 13 displays total. And some of these are only – it's still at this point ideas, you know, they're going to
right.
create this museum or they're going to house this collection, you know, here at this museum. They don't have a building for it yet, but they have a collection
mm-hmm.
and no place to put it. Or some of them are simply names that no one has really even like taken a photograph at this place and verified that it even exists. But they say, this place exists and there's a small collection of 25 vehicles, but it's way out in the middle of nowhere in kind of a warehouse looking type place. But again, 13, and this is from somebody who, you know, again, according to Hemmings, is a, I guess he's not a historian, but, you know, somebody who puts together lists of all known collections, you know, somebody who really digs in and does all the research. His name is Eric Van Ingren Schau, or Chanel, and he's from France, I believe. And again, he put together this list, and it's really of just 13 museums or public collections Some of them that which are closed, by the way, and others, again, just a name. There's really no photographic proof that they even really exist, but they're said to be out there. So almost like rumors that there's a collection out there. Mm-hmm. So it's very rare to find a true collection of cars, in China.
Right. But you can find them. Just because they're rare doesn't mean they don't exist, right?
Mm-hmm.
So this article came up with, 13 museums or public collections. Some of these you can access, as you said. So there's the Beijing International Automotive Expo Center, which looks so weird and cool. The building itself, it was currently under construction, expected to open in 2010.
Yeah. See, now we're talking about something in 2008 that was shown to be partially finished. Now, this is the way a lot of these are, Ben. This is in 2008. It was shown to be partially finished without the vast parking decks and all that they show around it and everything. Those weren't even there. So again, some of these are, maybe a little bit of,
vaporware.
Yeah. I was going to say vaporware. That's right. Yeah. You got the term exact.
Well, they did, finish constructing it. And so they do have the auto show 2015 there.
Oh, it's really done now.
Yeah.
Total. Oh, that's great news because, all I've seen so far are just renderings of what it was supposed to look like. I hope it's as beautiful as what these renderings are, because it really does look like a nice place to go.
Well, let's look at something a little further down the list, something that was not just a rendering while I was there, and something that's very interesting, at least to me as well, and that is the Liu Wenyao Classic Car Museum.
Ah, yes. Okay. Now, this one, I read a separate article from Motor Trend in which the author of this article went to Beijing and asked somebody who lived right there, all about this museum, and they said, I don't have any idea what you're talking about. And then finally, again, probably language barrier going on here as well, but they were trying to determine where this place was, what it looked like, what the, mm-hmm. Finally they narrowed it down to this one region. The author went out, found the place, and said that it was kind of strange because it looked like just a relatively nondescript gray museum, warehouse rather, that houses this collection of cars. And I believe it has almost 200 cars. But it has a lot of things from like old Russian vehicles, like Zills and Moskoviches and rocket launchers and BMW motorbikes and stuff like that.
A lot of domestic cars too.
Yeah, a few of those, but they also have some old American stuff, which is a surprise.
Right.
A Rolls Royce that was owned by Lenin and a bunch of cars that were just kind of parked outside all around. Like they don't have like the greatest of facilities. And when I looked at photos of this, because he posted a ton of photos from inside there. And the thing is, he said he paid his money, whatever it was, I don't know, $10 or something. Went in to see the collection. He's the only one in the museum. It's like it's basically deserted. It's out in the middle of nowhere. And if you're the only one in the museum, you got some pretty good opportunity to take some really nice photos. And there's a bunch of them online, again, in this Motor Trend article. Pretty good collection, an unusual collection. I'll tell you this. These cars are not the pristine, museum quality vehicles that you normally see.
They're not like Concours level.
No. In fact, a lot of them have, dents and some rust on them. They're not all completely beat up by any means, but they're not exactly what you would expect to find in a museum.
They're in the process of being restored. I mean, the owner is working.
To be fair.
On them.
Yeah. To be fair. And the guy's working on the cars outside. He doesn't even have like an inside garage. So he's working on them outside the museum and he drags them back inside.
Right.
But honestly, it's a really nice collection. There's a lot of really interesting vehicles there, but a little bit rough. It's almost as if you're looking at cars that were in an American museum in the basement, like the basement tour stuff.
Mm-hmm.
A little bit rough around the edges, still a nice example, but not pristine museum quality like we're accustomed to.
Yeah. And this is, to me, this is an interesting story because it feels like a labor of love.
Yeah.
Which I, when I see stuff like that, it makes me it makes him root for whomever's doing it.
Well, it's so hard to get these cars in, as you mentioned, because like this guy, I mean, what's his name? Liu Wenyao?
Uh-huh.
He says that, here's a quote in another article from USA Today. He says, something about the Beijing traffic police were giving him hassle over a Jeep that he had. And they said, well, your car has no doors. It's too dangerous to drive. And he said, well, it's the original design. This is a World War II Jeep. And mm-hmm. they designed it like that to save money. And they said, well, sorry, that's just, you can't do that here. So he's unable to keep that vehicle, or at least he couldn't drive it on the street anyways. So they're very strict about things like that there where, you know, here, it's a little bit more lenient, but imagine trying to import cars where it seems like everything is a stumbling block. You know, every little thing you would have to somehow get around. And that's what makes it difficult. This guy, you're right, Ben. He's collected, I think it's in the ballpark of 200 cars at this point. So a major, major collection, really. I mean, that's pretty good. That's a good size. And with the roadblocks and the stumbling blocks that he has, even more impressive.
And I have a little bit of news on that we could save till the end if you'd like.
Sure. So,
and on a future thing, right?
Oh, very good, yeah.
So we've talked about the challenge. Let's talk about some more museums.
Well, there's the Shanghai Automobile Museum, Ben. We can talk about that a little bit if you'd like.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
This is a pretty good collection here. It's open since 2007. And it claims to be the oldest operating public automobile museum in China. I'm having a difficult time saying automobile museums today for some reason.
Is it the new rural juror?
I think it might be, yeah.
Automobile museum. Yeah, it's a part of the Shanghai International Auto City. This has, it was around 40 cars for a while, and it may have expanded.
Well, they had 40 cars from the Blackhawk collection.
That's what it was.
Which is impressive. So they started with that and built it up from there.
Right, and the museum itself, you can visit anytime from 9:30 to 4 on Saturdays and Sundays if you're interested in that.
If you happen to be in Shanghai at this moment. Which,
right.
You know what? There's a chance.
They're closed on Mondays.
Worldwide audience, there's always a chance. And people travel there, of course. I mean, it's a communist nation, but people do travel there. Kristen Conger went from Stuff Mom Never Told You.
Mm-hmm.
She went last year, spent some time there.
Yeah.
Had a good time.
Her and her fiance went to the Great Wall, I think. Now, there's the Auto Museum itself has five pavilions. They've got a history pavilion, a tech pavilion, a brand pavilion, antique cars, which is going to be super interesting to a lot of people there, mm-hmm. and a temporary exhibition that just rotates through.
I bet this is impressive when you go there. I'm sure mm-hmm. it is. So probably one worth your time.
Oh yeah, I'd absolutely be. It's on my list to go. The other museums here. Let's see. What are some other ones that we should talk
about?
Well,
there's a couple here that look like they're. Again, I'm looking at renderings of them, so I don't know if they actually happened or not. One of those would be the Nanjing Museum.
Yeah, the Nanjing Auto Museum, called the Modern Goodwood Parking Garage, designed by award-winning designer Francesco Gatti. It's supposed to be dedicated to the automobile, with the space itself also being used as a parking spot.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. You start at the top of this museum and wind your way down through the exhibits. It seems like I've heard of other museums like this. There was one in Flint, Michigan, Autorama. Uh-huh. I think it was. Is that right? Maybe I'll have to look that one up as we talk here. But it's closed down now. You can't go to that one in Flint. But interesting design. I think it's kind of smart in that way.
Yeah, and I love the design of it. However, the fact of the matter is that the Nanjing Auto Museum has not yet opened.
Yeah.
It's just been a twinkle in the eyes of Chinese car lovers.
Oh, you know what, Ben? I got to interrupt you. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, yeah, go ahead.
I just remembered the name of that exhibit that I was talking about in Flint that shut down. It was called Auto World, and it closed about 6 months after the grand opening. So it was a terrible failure, but it had the same design in that you would spiral through the exhibits, and it was clever in a way. I mean,
cool.
It really was smart. It was a smart way to do it.
Where do you want to go next here? I feel like we can laundry list some museums, but I'd also like to at least take a break for a second and talk about a private collection that I think is really cool.
Let's do that right now.
All right. So there is a fellow named Eddie Yao in Hong Kong, and he, Scott, happens to own one of the largest Pagani collections in the world.
Ooh, that's an expensive collection. I mean, mm-hmm. to own one Pagani is a big deal.
Right. He has a Zonda R, a Zonda F, a Zonda F Roadster, two Zonda Syncs, and he also has a Mercedes-Benz, CLK GTR Coupe.
Yeah, I figured that was just the tip of the iceberg on this guy. So he lives in Hong Kong, though, right?
Uh-huh.
All right.
Well, that's one of his places.
I don't mean to cut you off. I mean, mm-hmm. do you have a list of vehicles that he has, or do you want to keep talking about other stuff? Because Hong Kong is an interesting place to own cars like that.
Yeah, I'll just do a list of a couple other vehicles that he has. He has two of those CLK GTRs, Ford GT40, Porsche Cup Racers, Lamborghini, a variety of Ferraris, F50, 288 GTO, Enzo, FXX.
All right, Rudy, there's your gajillionaire, Rudy.
Yeah, I think I know what you might be about to say. Where are you going with this?
The crowding issue. So let's say that you head out for the night on the town in Hong Kong in your Ford GT40.
Uh-huh.
What are you doing exactly? You're going to have 1,000 scooters all around you, first of all, or you're going to have a bunch of little commuter cars, you know, micro cars or whatever. Not micro, but, you know, compact cars.
Uh-huh.
That is a not-so-great situation for driving a big, very expensive vehicle through a crowded Hong Kong city. Mm-hmm. How does he do that, and where does he keep them? I mean, where do you keep it? Let's say that he's got I'm going to ballpark this. Let's say he's got 20 cars or more.
Okay.
Where do you keep those in Hong Kong? That's a prime location for parking, I'm sure. I mean, it's mm-hmm. got to be at a premium to park even one vehicle. So how do you park 20, 25 vehicles in a city like that?
There is a place for it. You see, Eddie Yao keeps his cars at his prestigious supercar collection in a place called SPS. It's in Hong Kong. It's a dealer that sells supercar and luxury cars. It also provides maintenance services, repair, car care, and car storage in Hong Kong. So if you check out this place, SPS, and Rudy, I think if you haven't seen this yet, for some reason, you'll really enjoy the pictures. These are cars that are closely packed together with like enough room to walk between them, mm-hmm. you know, but you have to do some valet tricks to move them all out.
Partially get in the door.
right.
Yeah,
and
squeeze in.
You can see just some amazing stuff here, and they're all maintained very well.
What's the name of the place again, Ben?
SPS.
SPS, and it's in Hong Kong. Uh-huh. And this guy's name is Eddie Yao. Mm-hmm. Do we know what Eddie Yao does, or do we not?
Eddie Yao.
Let me guess.
Guess.
Is he a music producer?
No.
Oh.
No, but that's a good guess. Hmm. I think you'll like this more. He is a race car driver.
Oh, race car. No kidding.
Mm-hmm. No kidding.
My second guess was going to be import-export.
My first guess was a legitimate businessman. No, I'm kidding. People who describe themselves as a legitimate businessman are usually not that flashy and usually not legit.
Yeah, my title is definitely a businessman.
Yeah, but he's he is a well-known Hong Kong racer. He won in Fuji, was a title contender on Asia Racing Team until the last race in Macau.
Hmm. That is a name I'm unfamiliar with, completely unfamiliar with it. So I'll have to dig into that.
Yeah, but he's a well-known racer in the area.
He must do quite well for himself.
He must do quite well.
Wow.
And he is a Pagani fan. So
apparently.
Yeah, so that's just one example of a private car collection. Now, those, of course, those are supercars far more than they are classic cars.
Yeah,
you know
so
what I mean?
He's not likely the buyer of the Ratsoy collection. Because,
no.
It's just not his game. It's not his style, not his bag, baby.
Yeah, SPS also supports him in the Asian Supercar Cup.
Ah.
So they have, like,
you know, can I just point out one other quick thing here? And this is, it's not really all that important or consequential or anything, but you may see some really oddball vehicles that are stuffed into some of these collections that you wouldn't normally see in a museum. So
that's true.
You know, at the one we just talked about, was it the Liu Wenyao exhibit?
Oh, yeah, loose cars, yeah.
You know, places like that. I don't know if, you know, specifically that one or not, but you might find like a mid 80s Cadillac or something like that. You know, that's not really all that remarkable here on the United States, but there, it's an oddity. It's something that you don't typically see, and that garners attention. Just as, you know, something from over there that's relatively ordinary would garner attention here in the States in the same museum, or in a different museum, but in a similar way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a right-hand drive vehicle will get a lot more attention, I guess, than a left-hand drive vehicle that's similar.
You know, I can see what you're saying. Yeah.
You know, it's ordinary. But, hey, there's a left-hand or right-hand drive version of it. You might peek your head in and take a look at it and give it a second glance, but even though it's not terribly remarkable in any other way. So, you know, it just depends on where you are and what you don't commonly see, and that's what makes these museums interesting.
Yeah, and there are several other museums in China that we didn't get to. The Beijing Motor Museum comes highly recommended. You'll see some unusual cars there. And also for a lot of travelers, Beijing, it might be the closest one to you.
Yeah. There's even a film studio car collection called
the
Imai Film Studio Car Collection. It's just some strange stuff, Ben.
Yeah. So we highly recommend checking these out. And I'd love to again hear anybody who's got a lead on that mysterious buyer of one of the best Canadian car collections. So let us know about that. We're about to wrap it up. Oh, wait, oh my gosh. I almost forgot.
Yeah.
I've got one more thing.
One more thing.
All right, Ben, so hit me with it. What is it?
So this year, news broke that China is going to discuss lifting the long-standing ban on importing historic vehicles. This story arrived to us in April, opening the world's biggest market to classic cars. So if they revoke those regulations, it'd be huge because the appetite for classic cars is rising dramatically. And this would have a global influence on pricing.
Wow, that's a big deal. It really is. I mean, to open up a market like that, and, you know, if prices had been faltering on certain types of vehicles in the UK, suddenly there's a new market for them, you know, a new place to kind of shop these around and maybe say, this is valuable, quite valuable.
Sure.
And, you know, it might boost some of that back up again.
Right. And so there's a place, the CVUC, again, the Classic Vehicle Union of China, they reckon they have about 400 members as of 2011.
Classic Vehicle Union of China.
Yeah, which is a little bit strange because these people own classic cars, but the importation of it is illegal.
How do they get around the
resale?
How do they get around the 15-year thing as well?
It must have been changing, but
strange.
And maybe it depends upon how the vehicle is qualified. Maybe that's part of the reason they go to a museum, because you can't import something to resell it. A used car like that,
and there's the loophole.
And maybe that's it. But I'd love to hear more about this, because although I'm fascinated by it, I feel like there's a lot more to the story.
Oh, definitely. It feels like there's big chunks of this missing, and I would love to dig into this even more and find out what we're missing exactly. Because, you know, this stuff changes monthly, I guess. Not daily, but monthly.
Right.
And, of course, you know, we've gone back decades even in this situation. So, you know, we've talked about stuff that's happened, you know, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, 20 years ago. It's all changing quickly. So this is an interesting, I guess we can call it a relatively new market for them. You know, the classic car market. It's interesting to see the way this thing all kind of shakes out, you know, where prices are going to go as a result.
Yeah.
What's going to be allowed, what's not going to be allowed. I'm kind of fascinated with the way they police the whole thing over there.
Yeah. I'm wondering, about the concerns for existing classic car markets, because I've heard some people saying what's going to happen is that they're going to drive up the prices dramatically, all these new people, because the people will treat it just as a stable investment. Mm-hmm. So if you have, you know, 10 people trying to buy the same car instead of two.
Yeah, but you can't look at an automobile as a stable investment, really. I mean, those things, they fluctuate so dramatically. But I see what you mean. It's dramatically changing the entire environment. They're going to reset the bar.
Yeah. And, I'm interested to see how it shakes out. I think that people should be allowed to invest in a collection if they want to. You know what I mean? It should be a level playing field.
Yeah, Ben, but that's probably part of what's, the problem with living in a communist run country is that there's a lot of heavy handed rules that are specifically set against something like this, you know, bringing in these quote Western ideas, you know, even though it's in an automobile that was, you know, built 30 years ago.
Yeah. You know, I see what you're saying. One thing though is that we have to remember classic cars are kind of like land, You know, kind of like what people used to say about real estate. They're not making any more of it, except out in the Middle East, right? we're building those islands. Now that I think about it, China is actually building some artificial islands in the South China Sea.
The analogy is moot.
Yeah, the analogy is ruined. But what we can say is that for the possibility of a much larger market for a smaller and smaller number of products, I guess if we want to look at classic cars that way, it's going to be very interesting to see how the next few years play out.
Absolutely.
So we'd like to hear from you listeners, especially your thoughts on this. Good thing, bad thing, why? Have you visited any of these Chinese car collections? Let Scott, Noel, and I know. You can find us at Facebook, Twitter. Check out every podcast we've ever done at our website, carstuffshow.com. Got any one more thing, Scott?
No. I was just going to say, how much of this nationalism do you really think should come into play here as well?
That's a good question.
If you have an opinion on that. Because I'm really interested in that. You know, we mentioned it a few times in this podcast, and I'd like to know how our listeners kind of shake out in this whole thing. Is it really that big of a deal if an American-made car goes over to China and, you know, lives in a collection over there? Because we have Chinese cars here in our collection.
Sure.
We have French cars here. We have German cars here, Italian cars.
British, yeah.
And I don't see them really protesting that those pieces of property are here now. It's just part of a bigger collection. And that happens. It's part of what makes this whole hobby, this whole thing interesting, is that, you know, you get this diversity, this sharing of vehicles back and forth across borders. And I guess maybe now that China has in a way opened its borders to other nations, you know, importing cars and allowing things like the, you know, the Ratsoy collection to go over there, it just might make it a lot more interesting for everybody, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And I, you know, my thing is, if the car is in a collection where it's being cared for and maintained, then isn't that good?
Yeah,
is
that's
that
good. And also, you know, the idea behind a whole collection going somewhere. Is it worse to be scattered, you know, among, you know, one here, one there, or should it remain together? I mean, it's kind of nice that 100 of those, you know, those cars are staying together. I know that there's still many of them that will be scattered, you know, the Ratsoy collections that have been scattered.
Sure,
But it's nice to know that, you know, there's a large chunk of them that have remained together. There's something, I guess, something comforting about that.
Well, let us know what you think. We're interested to see your thoughts and what you think the future of classic car collecting will be if there is this large new market that has opened up. You can tell us about it directly on all our social media, or you can take a page from Rudy's book and send us an email directly. We are
carstuff@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcast@HowStuffWorks.com.